It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, yesterday was the first day of the new fully Republican-controlled Congress. We'll look at what's in store in the coming weeks.
First, state attorneys representing the Department of Natural Resources are asking the United States Supreme Court to review a ruling that, if reversed, could pave the way for night deer hunting by the state's Chippewa tribes.
Off-reservation night hunting has been banned for the Chippewa since 1991, when Judge Barbara Crabb ruled that the state's ban applied to the tribes as well. However, a court of appeals ruled last year that Crabb must revisit that decision, something the DNR is now trying to bring to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Here to explain what's happening is Brandon Tomes, Director of Public Relations for the Lac des Flambeaux Tribe. Brandon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we heard a bit of the legal history there about how night deer hunting for the Chippewa tribes might be back on the table. Can you give us some background on how we got here?
Well, as many people know, the tribes, mainly the Chippewa tribes in Wisconsin, signed a series of treaties with the federal government. And through those treaties, specifically 1842 and 1854 treaties, ceded the northern two-thirds of the state to the federal government at the time. So in return for that land cession, the tribes retained the right to hunt, fish, and basically provide sustainability for their families within that land base. And, you know, some people are familiar with the treaty rights struggles of the tribes in the 80s and early 90s regarding off-reservation harvest of fish. And so through a number of court proceedings, we're faced with this latest development. In the tribes went back to the court last year and, you know, basically said, you know, the state has been allowing certain individuals and groups to hunt deer at night, and they've shown that it can be done safely. And so with that argument, you know, they appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and the decision was handed down by a three-judge panel. And, you know, I really think that the judge who authored that opinion, Judge Posner, you know, hit a lot of good points, and some of them, you know, are just common sense. You know, one of the initial rulings that prohibited the tribes from hunting at night specifically said that, you know, maybe they waited too long to, you know, bring this issue up, since they were referring to the previous action in 1991. So with that being said, you know, deer hunting is an incredibly important aspect of traditional Indian culture and heritage, and it's something that, you know, the tribes really need to sustain their populations.
And so legally, where is this issue right now?
Well, as you said, the state has asked the Supreme Court to review the ruling, and it's kind of in a holding pattern right now. So in October of 2014, Judge Posner, again, he wrote that he remanded the case back down to the district court. So in that, you know, he basically said that the state has to, you know, look at working with the tribes to, you know, develop a deer season, or, you know, some sort of regulations for them to be allowed to hunt deer at night, because it was demonstrated by, you know, state-authorized agencies and individuals that, you know, hunting could be done safely at night. So that's kind of where we're at. The tribes really, as far as, you know, I can't speak for all of the Ojibwe tribes, just Lac des Flambeaux in particular, but, you know, they're just kind of in a holding pattern. They're waiting and, you know, hoping for the best.
What was the Chippewa tribe's argument for off-reservation deer hunting at night?
Well, it hit on a number of key points. The main ones were that, again, that it was demonstrated since 1991, as many people know, the chronic wasting disease that hit the deer populations, especially in the southern portions of the state, was something that spurred, I guess, a legal night hunt. You know, certain groups and individuals were allowed to shoot diseased deer, or, as you know, some farmers and other individuals are allowed to dispatch nuisance deer, so to speak, deer that may be damaging crops or property. So through that, the tribes basically said, you know, It's been demonstrated that this can be done safely at night. There were no accidents. You know, nobody got killed. Nobody was injured. So, you know, with that, they asked the judge specifically, you know, it's been demonstrated, you know, let us take a shot at it, so to speak.
Now, other states do this right now, including our neighbor Minnesota, correct?
That is correct. I mean, there's a number of states, Montana, Minnesota. I mean, it's a pretty lengthy list that allow certain instances of night hunting. And, you know, as a point, the tribes have been hunting deer at night for generations, centuries. And it's not something that we're just making up or we've just grasped onto in the last 10 years. It's something that families grow up with, that we grow up teaching our children how to do this. You know, I remember as a child myself being out hunting at night. So it's really something that's ingrained in the very culture of who we are. So when we're speaking from a certain position on this topic, we're speaking in a position of expertise because it's something that people grow up with, and it's really important, I guess, to understand that aspect of it.
Now, safety has been at the core of the earlier ruling with Judge Crabb, which outlawed the practice. But there's a plan in place this time. What have the tribes said they intend to do to allay those concerns about safety?
Well, there's a safety plan that they propose to, a rigorous safety plan at that, they have proposed to implement for their hunters. And it includes a number of skill tests, marksmanship tests, you know, shooting at night. The hunters have to go out and scope out the area that they're proposing to hunt in. So they go and look for certain structures. Are there any dwellings in that area? Is there any human activity in that area? And they, you know, it's a really rigorous process and criteria that the tribes are proposing to implement upon their members. So it's really something that they've really looked long and hard at and worked very hard at developing these rigors.
Now, if this decision outlawing night hunting by the Chippewa tribes was to be reversed, do you expect that to be a controversial decision in Wisconsin among Wisconsin hunters who aren't part of that number?
Well, you know, I really hate to comment on that because either way, it's kind of a hot-button topic. It's a loaded question. I really, you know, I'm sure certain segments of the population wouldn't be pleased. But then again, you know, the judge in particular, he wrote in his decision that, excuse me, in a three judges panel decision, he wrote for them that there has been a number of car deer fatalities and accidents relating to, you know, accidents with deer. So the more deer that the Indians would kill, the less likely there would be to be accidents between vehicles and deer. So, I mean, it's really, you know, it's all about perspective. And, you know, I know that there are certain groups that wouldn't be happy, but for the most part, I think it's just it's a really insignificant number of deer that the tribes are impacting as far as, you know, their harvest numbers. So it's really just a drop in the bucket considering, you know, how many deer are out there and how many sports hunters there are.
And briefly, if this appeal to the Supreme Court is denied and Judge Crabb has to revisit her ruling, do you expect the outcome to be different?
I don't. I think that, you know, I just think that, I mean, literally there is going to be a change, obviously, with the hunt. But, I mean, I don't think it's any different than what we've already been doing. The tribes, again, have been hunting at night, and we continue to hunt at night on our reservations. And we've done so, you know, from the time I can remember and far longer back than that. So this is something that's really ingrained in the culture, and it's really... it's no news to us because we've been doing it. And I just really think that with the criteria that the tribes are proposing to implement as far as the safety regulations, that it's a non-factor. It's just something that, you know, people won't even know is happening.
Brandon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Brandon Tomes, Director of Public Relations for the Lac des Flambeaux Tribe. The new Congress is off and running in Washington, and it's our weekly look at what our legislators are up to with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
This is the legislature that will work with or against President Obama in his last 2 years as president. Republicans continue to hold the House, now hold the Senate as well, amounting to the largest Republican majority since just after World War II.
At the top of the docket for the new Congress are issues like the Keystone XL pipeline, which failed in the Senate at the end of the last session, as well as possible modifications to the Affordable Care Act.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. Well, Republicans kicked off the session. There's a little drama, maybe anticipation of rebellion in the vote for John Boehner to be in charge again. What ended up happening?
Well, yeah, it was a very tiny rebellion, but a rebellion nonetheless. There is a group of conservative members who believe that John Boehner has not been hardline enough with the Obama administration, particularly in trying to block Obama's use of executive authority for stuff like immigration. They decided they were not going to vote for John Boehner for Speaker, and if there was enough of them, they could have basically forced a second ballot, or it's not clear what they would have forced. They probably still would not be able to deny John Boehner the chair sooner or later. But in the end, there was about 25 of them, which is a pretty good number. It's about twice what it was 2 years ago when they tried a similar stunt. Still, John Boehner wins with 216 votes and is the Speaker of the House, and immediately began to punish some of those members who had voted against him. So, politics has its costs and its collateral damage, and this is that. It was interesting, but ultimately signified not much other than the fact that there are some people in the Republican caucus still unhappy with John Boehner and the sort of institutionalist Republicans.
Is this an indicator that there might be votes on issues where a similar group won't join with the Republican majority and Speaker Boehner would have to recruit Democrats to get something passed?
Yeah, that's a pretty good bet. I mean, that was a large part of the issue last Congress. That there were frequently, 40 or 50 Republicans who would bail out, and the Democrats would need, 20 or 30 Democrats to sign on to a bill to push it across the finish line. Would not surprise me if that is still the case. While the Republicans have expanded their majority in the House with the elections in November, some of the people they have added are at the most conservative edge of their caucus, and so will probably resist some of the same bills that essentially amount to compromise bills, even though the bills themselves are pretty conservative.
Turning to some of the legislation that Republicans want to get working on, yesterday two senators, actually Republican and a Democrat, I understand, introduced some Keystone XL pipeline authorization legislation. President Obama said, pass it and I'll veto it. So the first big controversy between the White House and the Republican Congress, maybe.
Yeah, I think it'll be the first showdown. This is a bill that, and it's kind of, politics is, again, a funny object. A year ago, well, sorry, not even a year ago, about 5 months ago, the Democrats were trying to push this bill all of a sudden because Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, a Democrat who was desperately trying to preserve her seat in the Senate, was pushing the bill because she knew it would be popular back home in Louisiana. They got it to a floor vote. The Democratic leader agreed to a floor vote. It lost. And so now we're back where we started. Now the Republicans are pushing the bill, and the Democrats are going to resist because President Obama has asked them not to pass this bill. He doesn't think it's a good idea for Congress to be just sort of authorizing these things without completing the permitting process with the reviews that he believes are appropriate. So, yeah, there will be some kind of a showdown. I think it's pretty clear they have enough votes in the Senate to pass this bill. I do not think it's clear they have enough votes to override a presidential veto, so we shall see. That will be exciting.
In the last 2 years, our big civics lesson, Paul, was what happens when one party controls one house, the other party controls the other. Are we going to have to brush off our veto knowledge over the next 2 years a lot?
You bet. That would be the anticipated outcome. And this is interesting because, as we talked about, I think, before the election, you and I, the question was, well, what's going to change even if the Republicans win? It's still going to be gridlock in Washington. Maybe, but what happens is it changes the location of the debate. So the debate in the last Congress was between the Republican House and the Democratic Senate, and that's where a lot of stuff died. Now the debate moves from the Republican House to the Republican Senate, and then to the president's desk. And that's where you hit a Democratic agenda, and that's where you get the pushback, and that's where the battle lines are now going to be drawn.
There have been occasional noises, hey, maybe we can work together, work some things out, find common ground, blah, blah, blah. Any indications with this first week that that's going to happen?
No. I mean, there's going to be a couple of bills that I think they can work together on. They've said they want to work together on a trade agreement in the Pacific, a U.S.-Pacific trade agreement, which is something that actually alienates a bunch of Midwestern Democrats, but that the Republicans and the coastal Democrats are likely to support. That's something that Obama could get behind and that Republicans would get behind. You could have some kind of a bipartisan agreement. There's a couple other things, little bits and pieces of things. But, you know, even while the Republicans would like to govern and prove that they can get to achievements with Obama, there's really still not a whole lot of upside for any of them to say, I compromised with President Obama. We stood at a signing ceremony together and took a picture. That's not very helpful in most political contexts.
So another big issue right out of the gate, the Affordable Care Act. Already the House passed the first Affordable Care Act bill of the session, exempting veterans from the employer mandate, a unanimous vote in the House, both
yes.
sides there. What does that do? Is it a big deal?
No. The big deal will be later on this week when the veterans one, I think, is pretty symbolic and pretty easy to pass. The bigger deal is going to be at the end of this week, I think, when they talk about changing the definition of a full-time work week for an employee covered by the mandate. And basically what this means is the way they wrote the bill, they defined a full-time employee who gets health care benefits as anybody working more than 30 hours. Republicans complained that 30-hour work week is not standard. 40-hour work week is standard. Democrats said, well, if we set the work week at 40, then all you got to do is put your employees on a 37-hour work week and none of them get health care. Republicans argue that, in fact, the other way around, that by changing the law, they have changed the way that employees will get benefits and work hours, and that's not a good thing, and that you're encouraging people to drive down the hours. That will be a big dispute probably later on this week as they try to move back to a 40-hour work week, as they call it, and expect Democrats and the Obama administration to furiously object.
Supposing they manage to pass these things, there's still this or other changes to the Affordable Care Act. There's still the veto threat. Do Republicans have any leverage when it comes to, say, funding for parts of the Affordable Care Act?
Possibly, sure. I mean, they do control the spending bills. They'll come back up in September, obviously, when the federal fiscal year runs out. There will be opportunities for Republicans to either defund various chunks of the government that operate the Affordable Care Act. They've already gone after the IRS in the most recent spending bill, cutting its budget. The IRS, of course, is responsible for processing the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. They could probably do more of this with the Department of Health and Human Services and say, well, you can't publish that rule. Those will be battles that they have, but all that stuff goes in legislation, which Obama can still veto. So it's just a question of how far they can push before they face a veto threat from the White House.
Now, yesterday, getting outside of Congress a bit, former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell sentenced to 2 years in prison for corruption, planning to appeal, I think. Rare sight, though, to see politicians potentially doing actual prison time?
Pretty rare sight, not unheard of. In fact, his lawyers had suggested, what if we just do community service? That was pretty laughable. The two-year, he was facing charges that could have gotten him somewhere between 10 and 15 years in prison. So the 2 years is kind of a gift from the judge. That was pretty nice, pretty lenient. But it's rare to send a politician to prison, but it's not unheard of. And obviously, the prosecutors pursued this case because they wanted to make a symbol of him, to make the point that, you know, if you do the crime, you will do the time, even if you're the governor of Virginia.
And briefly, Paul, the big news story today, of course, the tragic shooting at a satirical publication in France. We heard Secretary of State John Kerry address this. What's the buzz? Is this the buzz in Washington today?
Yeah, this has been the buzz everywhere. I mean, obviously, it's a tragedy. For those of us who are in journalism, it is a particularly, you know, close-to-home kind of issue. We're in the satire business frequently, and, you know, freedom of speech is the thing we value more than anything else. So this definitely is, you know, a moment of some tragedy. Also, I mean, honestly, you have to, this newspaper had been targeted before for attacks. I guess it's not all that surprising, but it doesn't make it any less tragic.
Paul, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Be well. Happy New Year.
To you, too. We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to share the scoop on what Congress is and isn't getting done.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As the current NBC News political director, our next guest has had an insider's view of the Barack Obama presidency, from his remarkable campaign to his two terms as the first African-American president of the United States. Obama's outsider status helped propel him to office, along with his interest in bypassing the partisan infighting of the past. He ran on a platform of unification, hope, and change. Here's a clip from the president's victory speech, election night 2008.
There's new energy to harness, new jobs to be created, new schools to build, and threats to meet, alliances to repair. The road ahead will be long. Our climb will be steep. We may not get there in 1 year or even in one term, but America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there. I promise you, we as a people will get there.
With 2 years left in the Obama presidency, though, how has the president delivered on the promises of his campaign? And how has his outsider status played out when it comes to his goal of bringing transformation to Washington? Chuck Todd tries to answer those questions in his new book, The Stranger, Barack Obama in the White House. Todd is a veteran journalist at NBC News, where he served as the chief White House correspondent from 2008 to 2014. He's also the moderator of Meet the Press. Chuck, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to do it. And since it's Wisconsin, I get to say go Packers.
You sure can. We have a game Friday.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
Well, you call Obama the stranger, the title of your book. What does that word mean to you in the context of the Obama presidency?
I think it was having to do with sort of the, it's sort of stranger to Washington, stranger to the sort of the bad political habits. Some people might view them as bad political habits of how Washington works. Stranger to that system, and vice versa. A lot of Washington didn't know him, and so that's sort of, I think, the crux of sort of why I picked that title as opposed to, you know, outsider, loner, whatever, the different versions that you want to do. And ultimately, it really is sort of it really just sort of came about on this idea that he was. Brought to change Washington, has never comfortably fit in. Many presidents never comfortably fit into Washington, you know, because a lot of them run against Washington in order to succeed and get there, and Barack Obama was no different. But I think the heart of the problems that he faced, the political problems that he faced in those first 4 or 5 years, all came to do with sort of this lack of the fact that in many ways, they're still strangers with each other. I mean, it was just last month another anecdote about how a whole bunch of House Democrats were being called by the president to try to convince them to vote for this budget deal. And the snarky answers that these House Democrats had, oh, I didn't know you had my number.
Hmm. Well, Obama ran on a platform of change, and that outsider status is part of that. He said he wouldn't be someone who'd play into partisan politics, who'd try to change the way the whole system worked. And instead, his time in the White House, it's been marked by gridlock and amped up partisan politics. Why hasn't he been more successful in changing the way politics work in Washington?
Well, I can give you sort of two views of it. I mean, I think so Rahm Emanuel is first chief of staff. His answer to this question is as follows, and it's sort of where the president is, which is, you know, he didn't end up with the presidency that he thought he was going to have. Many presidents don't. You know, George W. Bush, obviously, he didn't talk about a Bush doctrine and wasn't talking about preemptive war and things like that during the 2000 campaign. It was pre-9/11. And, you know, Barack Obama, up until September 15th of 2008, wasn't talking a lot about derivatives and the need to rescue Wall Street and the auto industry and things like that. the trajectory of his presidency changed the minute September 15th, 2008 happened and the collapse of the financial markets. So the Rahm Emanuel answer to that question will be, yes, he was elected to change Washington, but he didn't have the luxury or time to change it because he had an economic crisis to deal with. So that's their answer to this. I think that there were ways in the relationships with Congress and how to work with Congress, how to coerce Congress to do things, you know, his agenda versus allowing them to dictate the terms of the debate. I think that's where he could have made some progress and didn't, simply by, I would argue, mistakes they made early on. One anecdote that I use early on is a spending bill that had the president vetoed, I think it would have changed the relationship between he and congressional Democrats in a way that would have perhaps, say, sped up how the health care bill so that it didn't stall for as long as it stalled in 2009, which ended up, of course, arguably derailing parts of his domestic agenda that he wanted to get done in his first term, and he never could.
You tell another story in your book about a reach out that President, well, that Obama did with Joe Biden. I think this is before his presidency when, not Joe Biden, with John McCain, wanted to reach out across the aisle. And there was real feeling from John McCain that there might be a promising partnership here, but it didn't work out.
It didn't. And it had to do with it was some lobbying reform and early on. And the president ran on it the president, obviously he was a Senate candidate when he ran on this issue in 2004, and he saw, and he was always looking for Republicans to work with, and John McCain, somebody has never shied away from trying to attach himself to a rising star the minute they get in the Senate and try to do some work with him. And so it looked like that they were going to be able to do some business. And when McCain, who is very comfortable bucking his leadership, he didn't think Barack Obama was willing to buck Harry Reid enough when it came to doing the deal that needed to be done, or at least that John McCain thought it would to be done. And so very, very early on, after it looked like they were going to do this lobbying deal together, then Senator Obama said, well, I can't do it. I got to go back and talk to other Democrats about this. And then McCain just lit into him, and he just didn't like that style and felt as if he was being used by Obama, and it really sort of soured that relationship from the start. And then, of course, when they actually ran against each other, it really sort of a one-way thing. I mean, Obama's never had the level of bitterness about McCain that McCain has about the president.
That's just one story. You tell lots of others in the book, and all of them somehow get at this notion that Obama seems to have trouble forging relationships with Capitol Hill regulars, even people he had a big stake in getting to know, like Nancy Pelosi.
And I think some of it has to do with, you know, there's a basic what I think is one of the president's great strengths and weaknesses all at the same time, which is he is not a political animal, and he's in many ways as cynical about it. He's sort of irrational about the process, and like, are you mean we have to do what in order to get some bill passed? Or, you know, there's a story in there I talk about during the oil spill when Robert Gibbs, then the White House press secretary, goes into the president and he says, you know, Mr. President, you know, people need to see you looking angry. And his response is, and how much oil is that going to clean up? And Robert's response is, none, but it's going to buy you some time and space so that you can get the job done without a lot of micromanaging and chirping from the media. And it's sort of the political theatrics. And in his relationships with Congress, Barack Obama's not a guy that needed backslaps, even when he was in the Illinois State Senate, needed, you know, the leadership coming up to him saying, you're doing a good job, you know, do this bill for us, do this for us. That's just not who he is. And so because he doesn't need it, he doesn't necessarily know how to deliver it, because there are a lot of people on Capitol Hill that are kind of needy about it. And that's just not something that the president, that comes naturally to this president.
You point out, though, he may not be a president who likes politics. If Bill Clinton was a president who liked the backroom deals, who liked, as you said, the backslapping and all of that, that President Obama does not enjoy that. Is that a paradox for any political figure to be in that position and not like, or maybe even, as you question, be good at the politics?
Well, and by the way, I want to, there's two different types of politics. And when I say the president isn't, there's the behind the scenes backstopping, the art of the political deal, and then there is campaign politics. President Obama enjoys the campaign style of politics. He enjoys being out on the stump. He enjoys doing rallies. So I don't want to leave the impression that he doesn't like all politics, but it's sort of the necessary, what I call the necessary evil of politics, of the behind-the-scenes stuff, that he enjoys less. I mean, he thinks it's almost an irrational process sometimes to watch people that he knows could meet him halfway but won't because of some sort of constituency issue that they're worried about. And that just he can't put his arms around it as well, and doesn't. He really almost doesn't respect that point of view when people sort of talk about their own personal politics as a reason not to do something or not to compromise. And so, and that comes across, and I think that leads to the suddenly where you get to the point where they just can't come to an agreement.
We're talking right now with veteran journalist Chuck Todd. He's the NBC News political director and the moderator of Meet the Press. He's also the author of the new book, The Stranger, Barack Obama in the White House. He's also been the chief White House correspondent for NBC News from 2008 to 2014. When we come back, we'll take a look at Barack Obama and what happened with the Affordable Care Act.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. How do you think President Obama did on putting into practice the kind of changes he talked about during his campaign for president? Who do you blame for gridlock in Washington, the president and his leadership style, or Congress? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking with journalist Chuck Todd. He's the NBC News political director and the moderator of Meet the Press. His new book is called The Stranger, Barack Obama in the White House.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's leadership, his ability to fulfill the campaign promises and goals he set in his first election campaign? Do you think an effective president needs to have a knack for cutting deals, maybe in a backroom Washington kind of way? Does it hurt President Obama that he ran as an outsider? Call in at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org.
Now, before we get to calls, I want to talk a little bit about the president's signature piece of legislation so far, the Affordable Care Act. Now, there were pretty big majorities for the president in the House and the Senate, and yet there were a lot of bumps along the way. As you see it, what went wrong there?
Oh, I have I sort of have this theory of the butterfly effect. And at the end of the day, when you look at you can make an argument that all of the problems that the Affordable Care Act has faced, including right now with the yet another Supreme Court challenge to one part of the law, all goes back to Tom Daschle, the former Senate Majority Leader, who was in line to be essentially the CEO of all things health care. They had this idea very early on when the president asked Daschle to be his Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Daschle said, "I'll only do it if I have an office in the West Wing," which was unprecedented for something like that. And they created the Office of Public Health. The idea was that, okay, this would be the headquarters of how you would get health care passed. So the idea was this would be, he essentially would be wearing two hats, but he'd be the CEO of all things health care. Well, Daschle doesn't get confirmed. He has this tax issue. When you think about it, a Senate majority leader can't convince a bunch of senators to overlook this, but that, a Democratic Senate, no less. But you know, we could pour through that. I go through that story. But if you think about it, they never replaced Daschle. So then they split Daschle's job among two people. So at that point on, you never had one person in charge. And ultimately, when you think about all of the issues that the healthcare law went through from creating it and not having sort of a single point person to run point, both in the Senate or the House, that was going to be Daschle. They never had that. To the implementation problems that it had, when you go for nearly a year and no one is really in charge of implementation. You know, Kathleen Sebelius, who eventually is the president's choice to be at HHS when Daschle's nomination falls through, she had somebody in mind, but then there was somebody at the White House that they had in mind. But there never really was one person in charge. And so when you don't have that one person being held accountable and in charge of this whole thing, well, then you go through. And if you see all of the problems it faced, I'd argue you can trace it all the way back to Tom Daschle, his tax problems, and that being the butterfly effect of all the political problems that the health care law took on. And from the bad, from the inability to get rid of the bad language in the law that they thought they were going to be able to get rid of when they would reconcile the bill between the House and the Senate. Of course, there ended up not being reconciliation. I apologize for going through that part of it, but, you know, and how a bill becomes a law. You know, that normally sometimes you pass some things in the House and some things are worded differently in the Senate bill, but of course because of the Scott Brown election and the fact that there weren't going to be 60 votes in the Senate, the only way they were going to get health care in is if they passed the bill with identical language. So, well, and guess what? It turned out some of that language was pretty badly, in some cases, pretty badly worded, and it's frankly the basis for this latest Supreme Court challenge.
Let's go to our phones right now. We have Linda on the line with us in Wauwatosa. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'm just calling in to give my opinion on how I feel the president's done in his term. And I'll tell you this, he's an amazing, intelligent, and anything else you can think of. But what he was up against, I don't see how anybody could have got anything done. And, you know, I was listening about the Affordable Care Act. You know, so many years, 20 years of politicians talking about, before they get into office, we're going to have health care reform. This is something they just say just to get the vote, but no one's ever tried to tackle that. He's got the wheels turning. And this is the same thing that happened with Social Security. It's a safety net for, you know, some. We are all human beings, should have some humanity. We have to help our brothers. We got to help people that are less fortunate, and there always will be less fortunate people.
Okay, thanks a lot for your thoughts on that, Linda. And to look at one aspect of that, Chuck, you write that early on the Republican strategy was decided on. It was to block Obama at every turn to stop him from getting bipartisan approval, which would just cement his image as a successful president. Is that part of what we're looking at here when we look at the difficulty with legislation?
Absolutely. That was part of it, too. I mean, you know, it's funny. If I could war game the Obama presidency and be able to say what would his presidency have looked like had instead of 59 Democratic senators coming in with his election in 2008, it was, say, 54. And the reason I say this is, let's say from the very beginning, he always needed somewhere between 6 and 10 Republican senators in order to get anything passed in the Senate, anything major passed in the Senate. Then the efforts to woo Republicans were because they had to, and vice versa. When you got into the large majorities that the president ended up having, the fact of the matter is the White House did reach out to Republicans, but on their terms. Right, on their own terms. They said, you know, we'd like to work with you. Here's a few areas that we think, you know, we could work together. Essentially, take it or leave it. Republicans also, had they been responsible for governing, would have felt responsible. Well, you know what? We have to work with them where we can because, you know, the numbers are the numbers. But because Democrats were in such a dominant place, they didn't have to work with him to make government function, to get this stuff done. And so there was no incentive for either side to work with each other early on, and so then it ends up becoming basically a relationship which you have your best chance of developing bipartisan relationships in your first year and a half. Reagan did it. It was by necessity because he had a Democratic House of Representatives that he had to deal with. Bush did it. Clinton eventually had, you know, Clinton sort of had the same asset/liability that Obama had coming in. He had large majorities in the House and Senate, but then quickly lost them, and then for survival ended up forging some Republican relationships when he needed to. But I've always wondered if things would have been different if both Republicans and the White House had more skin in where they needed each other earlier on. And the fact of the matter is Democrats didn't need Republican help to govern in 2009. And Republicans had no responsibility to participate because their numbers were so, you know, they were in such a minority spot.
Now, looking ahead, you've got a theory that people elect a president that has the qualities that the president before him lacked. And as an example, voters thought George W. Bush saw the world in terms of absolutes, good and evil, right and wrong. And then along came Barack Obama, who saw a nuanced place in shades of gray. So with that theory in mind, and just briefly, since we're getting a bit short of time here,
right,
who do you think of the known contenders for president next time around? Who do you think fits the bill as a would-be successor to Barack Obama?
Well, I think what it means, it's going to be the familiar sort of thick-skinned, familiar politician. So under this theory, and if it works pretty well, you can go back in the whole modern era of the presidency, and in many ways, whatever the weakest characteristic was of the president that's left office, you know, the succeeding president sort of represented that, had the best quality of that, whether it was Bill Clinton being, you know, to Bill Clinton being more of a feel your pain type of politician, the non-patrician George H.W. Bush more the patrician, and et cetera. So then you would look at Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, both of whom are basically hardened politicians, right? Through the system, have been through so many battles. So the last person you would expect is a first-term senator or an outsider that the country is more likely to turn to, a battle-hardened veteran politician.
And we leave it there. Chuck, thank you so much for your time.
You got it.
We're speaking to Chuck Todd, NBC News political director and the author of The Stranger, Barack Obama in the White House. Light news of the day. People like dogs, mm-hmm. and people like those charts showing the most popular names of the year.
Yep.
Well, now some new research is bringing both of those things together.
Yeah, the pro-dog website, radical pro-dog website, Rover.com, went through their databases from their dog fans. They came up with top 10 lists from the most common dog names of 2014.
Here's some of the top names for male dogs. We had Max, followed by Buddy and Charlie and Jack and Cooper. And for female dogs, Bella, I guess maybe from the Twilight books. Mm. And then Lucy, Daisy, Molly, and Lola. And a dog in my family, Sophie.
And there's a lot of people names. As you go down the list, there's a lot more. And this is going to encourage dogs, more and more dogs, to think they're people.
Or cast members from Game of Thrones, apparently.
Right, yeah. That's a big trend, big jumps in Game of Thrones names like Khaleesi, Tyrion, Daenerys, and Sansa, and Frozen, no surprise
Frozen,
there.
Frozen, that leaves Elsa, Olaf, Hans, Anna, or Anna, or Kristoff.
And there's a dog of your dreams, and it would be named Veronica.
Winston.
I hear a lot about Winston, the hypothetical
Winston
dog.
Winston in 2015, I believe. If you want to sign on, let me know.